very much, sir. Thank you very much for coming to this session. We're here to launch a very important paper, Child Poverty in the Developing World. And I'm delighted, as Director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights at the LSE, to have this opportunity to welcome you all. But in doing so, I'd like to acknowledge the enormous contribution to this report from, on my far left, Professor Peter Townsend, who's based here at the LSE, and who is the Professor of International Social Policy at the LSE, and particularly also, right next to me, Professor David Gordon, who is the Director of the Townsend Centre for International Poverty Research at the University of Bristol, and also Professor of Social Justice at Bristol, who has, with his team at Bristol, been a lead agent in the production of this important report. It would not exist in the form that it exists today without the immense support from UNICEF, and we are also delighted to have present on my right Elizabeth Gibbons, who is, she tells me, Chief of Global Policy at UNICEF. But we had a complex cultural discussion. We decided you wouldn't understand the word chief, and we've decided that she is, for today only, head of global policy at UNICEF. And last, but of course not least, it gives me and will give me enormous pleasure to welcome back to the LSE and to the Centre the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, the current Director of the Ethical Globalisation Initiative, and of course also, I have to say, naturally, former President of the Republic of Ireland, Mary Robinson. So these are our four speakers at this important topic. The menu for the event is that I'll invite first David to say a few words, and then I'll invite Elizabeth, and then Peter, whilst you're all turning off your mobile telephones. And I'll then ask Mary to deliver what will be the keynote speech on this topic. We do need to end at around 2:30. I'm being corrected by the person to my right, not at around 2:30, at exactly 2:30. And therefore, whilst we are very keen to have space for questions afterwards, and because of that, the speakers will, at least the first three, be relatively concise, and Mary will no doubt be aware of the need for some questions, we will be afterwards asking for pretty concise questions and comments. So let's hope that we have enough time for that as well. Without any further ado, therefore, I would particularly then like to ask David Gordon from Bristol to commence the proceedings this lunchtime. David.
Good afternoon. Is this working? Yeah. I'm only going to speak briefly for 2 minutes because I want to hear Mary speak, and I'm sure you all have come to hear Mary speak. I'm delighted that Mary Robinson has come to discuss this report and to discuss the important issue of child rights and child poverty. This year, the majority of people who will die in the United Kingdom will be over the age of 75. This is true across the industrialized world. Unfortunately, in the developing world, where the majority of the people live, most people who will die will be young children under the age of 5, and many of them just babies. And the reason they will die is because of the effects of grinding poverty, particularly lack of sanitation, clean water, lack of adequate health care. The right to life is the most fundamental right of human right of all. Poverty is violating the human rights of large numbers, tens of millions of children in the developing world today. This report, for the first time, measures the extent, depth, and nature of child poverty in the developing world, where most of the world's poor children are. We found that over 1 billion children, more than half of children in the developing world, were suffering from severe deprivation of basic human needs. This is deprivations that are so severe that they will have an impact on their health and their development. They inevitably will suffer long-term and short-term damage from this level of poverty and deprivation. We also found that a third of children, more than a third of children in the developing world, 675 million, were suffering from multiple deprivations of basic human need. They were living in absolute poverty as agreed by the governments of 117 countries at the World Summit on Social Development in Copenhagen. In particular, the majority of child poverty in the world is in rural areas, particularly in South Asia, in the Indian subcontinent, and in sub-Saharan Africa. In these areas, 80% of children in some countries are suffering from absolute poverty. That's 4 out of 5. It's no wonder that the death rates are so high for young children. We also found that although a lot of effort has been successful into what are called human capital interventions in alleviating poverty, improving health, improving education, reducing the extent of malnutrition through various feeding programs and health interventions, that almost 1 billion children were suffering from deprivation of physical capital. They did not have access to clean water, they did not have access to any toilet facilities whatsoever, and they lived in squalid housing conditions with more than 5 people to a room, with mud flooring, within adequate build. It's these kinds of physical capital conditions that lead to the ill health and lack of educational attainment, and the world needs to address the physical capital problems as well as the human capital problems of children in the world today. And I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, David. Elizabeth.
Thank you, and this is an opportunity for UNICEF to thank Professors Townsend and Gordon for really this extremely important report that has, with a very innovative methodology, taking data on children's situation, which UNICEF has been monitoring for many years, and putting it in the context of poverty. As in doing so, it's put children then at the center of the poverty debate for the first time. And children who are not objectified as poor, or children who are not objects of a household, a poor household, but children in their own right, with a full range of rights to develop their full potential. It focuses on then the environment that deprives children of that right. They are not just born poor, but their environment does not facilitate the development of their full potential and the fulfillment of their rights. So that it starts from the child's perspective, and it sees this deprivation as a web of failures in its environment, and calls on all of us then to look at who is responsible for those failures, how can they be addressed. And so it forces us to look also at the intersectoral nature of the causes of child poverty, and the indivisibility of human rights is one of the key principles, and the study helps us also to look at that. What we hope from this is generate a lot of debate, generate many more papers regarding this important subject, but in particular to begin a process whereby the fulfillment of children's rights and the necessities, the deprivations that they face, be addressed not through residuals left over from economic reform programs or a residual investment in social sector, but really it becomes the center of poverty reduction strategies. So with that, again, I also look forward very much to the next interventions, particularly Mary Robinson, and thank you all for being here.
And thirdly, Peter.
It was only last year that Carol Bellamy, the executive director of UNICEF, said that in reporting progress on the issue of children's deprivation, said there was a mixture, I'm quoting her, of conspicuous achievements and dispiriting failure. Most people in this room have some sense of that, that on the one hand one can argue that some countries have made progress that is measurable, but there are too many exceptions, and because of growing inequality in the world, that looks, the solution looks very far off. In this report and the full report subsequently, we will be trying to suggest that it's partly a question of methodology as well as a question of analysis and also a question of policy. And the principal idea here is that we have to focus on priorities and intelligently state what the problem is, that we're faced often enough with the choice between the argument for that there are insufficient resources, or that the problem is a multi-dimensional one of deprivation. And these tend to take us off in somewhat different directions. We have tried to show that articles of human rights can be assembled in a way which, as it were, allows the issue of multiple deprivation to be decided more than has been the convention in the past. We've also attempted to suggest that, as a consequence of that, some of the human rights, the fundamental rights that have existed, particularly in the Declaration on Human Rights and the Convention on the Rights of the Child, have elements in them which must be sustained, namely the right to social security and the right to an adequate standard of living. And partly in the view that we have to build on agreements of the past and some of the many countries who've signed up to the World Summit arrangements, as for instance, those on children in 1990 and in 1995 in Copenhagen, the World Summit on Social Development. We've tried to build on that as social scientists to suggest that a different strategy, different set of policies to those which are conventionally authorized at present in the world need to be developed. Among them, we've suggested that an investment fund in children ought to be given very serious consideration, one that is partly financed by international means, perhaps through a Tobin-style tax, an international financial transactions tax, and that those resources ought to be used in developing an infrastructure to deliver child benefit in much more serious ways in a large number of the poorest countries. We believe that is a direct form of benefit, which is measurable and capable of being monitored, rather than the present indirect strategies of economic growth, debt relief, and overseas aid. They are, let us say, largely distributive strategies. And we have to try to understand that if we want to give young children priority, we have to devise some direct forms of policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter, very much. And now to deliver what is this lunchtime talk's keynote address on children's rights and child poverty, it gives me great pleasure to ask Mary Robinson.
Thank you very much. It's really very nice to be back here in LSE, and I remember so well, Connor, the launch of your Centre for Human Rights and the wild party that night. It was all very enjoyable. So it is a pleasure to return to participate in the launch of the report Child Poverty in the Developing World. Part of the reason I came up to stand at the rostrum is that nobody's shown you what we're launching. I mean, we all have it at the table. I mean, I'm not sure who else has seen it, but anyway, this is it. And it is a very important work. As you've heard, It's a study commissioned by UNICEF and co-authored by the Townsend Centre for International Poverty Research at the University of Bristol and the London School of Economics. And its findings, I believe, are a stark wake-up call, bringing home to us how bleak the situation is for millions of children today. This is a moral challenge we cannot ignore. As many of you are aware, LSE's work on poverty, on women and children's poverty in particular, goes back over a century to the days of Fabianism. Founders Sidney and Beatrice Webb were both deeply committed to war against poverty, the title of a 1912 pamphlet they co-wrote with Ramsay MacDonald and George Bernard Shaw. The very first public conference on family allowances was held at LSE in 1927. The library here holds treasures of materials on the early thinking of politicians and reformers on poverty and the origins of the welfare state. As for my friend Peter Townsend, you all know his extraordinary commitment to action against world poverty, and you've heard him today. And you know that the Townsend Centre for International Poverty Research has authored powerful, courageous studies on the extent of world poverty and the need for new international strategies. So let's reflect for a moment on globalization. Globalization, the progressive integration of economies and societies, has, as we all know, greatly accelerated in the last decade. This process, it was hoped, would help lift millions out of poverty and raise living standards in the poorest corners of the world. Unfortunately, as we head towards the close of the first United Nations decade for the eradication of poverty, that is 1997 to 2006, the reality is proving much more complicated. While China and India have indeed brought millions out of poverty, 54 countries have grown poorer in the last decade. Even in countries that have experienced economic growth, the poor have not necessarily been lifted out of poverty, but rather have been left further behind. Poverty is widely understood today as a deprivation of basic human needs, including food, safe drinking water, sanitation facilities, healthcare, shelter, education, and information. It's also characterized by unsafe environments and social discrimination and exclusion, by lack of participation in decision-making and in civil, social, and cultural life. When we on ending and threaten children's very survival or cause permanent damage, physical or mental or both. It can destroy opportunities of fulfillment forever and feeds an unending cycle of poverty. And this is why UNICEF insists that, and I quote, poverty reduction begins with children. But what isn't considered so often is this perspective. Poverty is a violation of internationally agreed human rights. How differently would we go about fighting child poverty in the world today if we took seriously the commitments which practically every nation has made to their children by ratifying the Convention on the Rights of the Child? By understanding and insisting on implementation of these legal commitments, we open up new possibilities for participation in decision-making, and we set new tests of accountability for governments from both developed and developing countries alike. I'm very pleased that tomorrow, at a conference here in LSE, and I've seen your programme, the findings of this new study will be examined from the perspective of child rights. And I do encourage as many of you as possible to participate in these discussions. The report's findings show just how far we are from ensuring the rights of children around the world. Again, as was summarized by Professor David Gordon, over 1 billion children, more than half of all children in developing countries, suffer from severe deprivation of at least one basic human need, such as food, safe drinking water, sanitation facilities, or healthcare. The report shows that over a third of children in developing countries suffer from absolute poverty, defined as two or more severe deprivations. Study's findings are based on a sample of nearly 1.2 million children from 46 developing countries, the largest and most accurate sample of children ever assembled. The author's aim was to measure the poverty of children themselves, as has been emphasized, rather than that of larger units, such as families, communities, or countries. Equally important, it's the first study to use a human rights definition of poverty, rather than the more standard and arbitrary economic measurements of GDP per capita or income per capita. Considerable differences between countries and regions were found, with children in rural areas most likely to be absolutely poor or severely deprived. Significant gender differences were also found with regard to education deprivation, showing the extent of discrimination against the girl child, especially in South Asia, North Africa, and the Middle East. Sub-Saharan Africa has the highest level of absolute poverty, with a staggering 65% of 207 million children living in absolute poverty. South Asia is not far behind, with 59% of 330 million children living in absolute poverty. These figures accuse us because we cannot plead ignorance. In fact, after a couple of years serving as UN High Commissioner and trying to give leadership on human rights and travelling to a lot of countries and seeing what we mean by those two words, absolute poverty, I used to be asked by journalists over and over again, High Commissioner, what's the worst problem in human rights? And I would answer, and they didn't like the answer, I would say absolute poverty. That's the worst problem in human rights, because you have no rights. And I find it difficult when I read these statistics to find words to try to say, what does this mean? And sometimes when I have difficulty trying to express things in words, I turn to those who are the artists of words, to poets. And I'd like to quote some lines that were written early in the last century by Anna Akhmatova. She wrote a bleak poem called Why Is This Age Worse? Why is this age worse than earlier ages? In a stupor of grief and dread, have we not fingered the foulest wounds and left them unhealed by our hands? Might we not ask the same question, knowing of the foulest wounds of the suffering of millions of children in our resource-rich world? What must be done to change this situation? In fact, we began the 21st century with an important signal of new commitment. You'll recall that in September 2000, the largest ever gathering of heads of state adopted the United Nations Millennium Declaration, recognizing that they had, and I quote, a collective responsibility to uphold the principles of human dignity, equality, and equity at the global level. The leaders emphasized their, and again I quote, duty to all the world's people, especially the most vulnerable, and in particular, the children of the world, to whom the future belongs, end quote. Among other promises, leaders of all countries, rich and poor, committed themselves to a series of measurable targets known as the Millennium Development Goals. Poverty is at the core of the Millennium Agenda, with countries pledging to reach benchmarks for eradicating extreme poverty and hunger, improving access to safe water, reducing child mortality, improving maternal health, and combating HIV and AIDS, malaria, and other diseases by 2015. That's the timeline. And 2015 is now in 12 years' time. Yet, we know that 3 years later into the agenda, we are falling short on all of these commitments. According to the 2003 UN Human Development Report, in 21 countries today, more people are going hungry. Infant mortality has increased in 14 countries, and life expectancy has fallen in 34 countries. At the current rate, Africa in particular would not meet some of these goals until 150 years from now. Not 2015, 150 years from now. As Shailen Nandi, who's sitting in the middle of us here, of the University of Bristol, one of the co-authors of the report we are launching today, has put it, and I quote him, at this rate, the UN Millennium Development Goals are unlikely to be met, given declining international commitment to development aid. The results of cutting public spending on basic social services have been an increase in poverty and inequality a fact which organizations like the World Bank need to acknowledge. The new report tells us that one-size-fits-all solutions and business as usual will not do. Anti-poverty strategies need to respond to local conditions. More emphasis needs to be placed on improving basic infrastructure and social services for families with children, with a particular focus on shelter and sanitation in rural areas. The report stresses that a lack of investment in good quality education, health, and other public services in many parts of the world is as significant a cause of child poverty as low family incomes. At the international level, the report proposes an international investment fund, as Peter has reminded us, for payment towards national schemes of child benefit, in cash or kind, as a means to provide the impetus for rapid fulfilment of children's fundamental right to a standard of living adequate for their physical, mental, spiritual, moral, and social development. Further, the report strongly recommends that UNICEF and other international agencies should campaign for a legal right to child benefit. In the 21st century, we all know that access to information is fundamental. The need for such access is emphasized in this report as one of the basic needs of children of today. The report singles out improvements to radio access as the most effective way to improve child access to information, and recommends that UN agencies raise the profile of the issue of information deprivation. In May 2002, in advance of the UN General Assembly's special session on children, a meeting was held in New York of the representatives of independent children's rights commissioners, or ombudsmen. I always stop at ombudsmen these days and kind of say, or do I say ombudspersons, but anyway, with legal authority to promote, protect, and monitor children's rights from some 30 countries around the world. And in assessing the progress that had been achieved in the 12 and a half years since the Assembly's adoption of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the commissioners and ombudspersons, I'm going to call them, proclaimed, "We cannot tolerate another decade of non-compliance with the Convention on the Rights of the Child. After decades of international standard-setting activities and ratifying human rights treaties, states must focus on their full implementation. Having rights on paper means little or nothing when they are not known about or cannot be enforced. We can and must do better." End quote. What will it take to do better? My conviction is that we need a new strategy, which is exemplified by this report and the title of tomorrow's conference. Simply said, we need to explore the synergies between human rights and development. In this case, it means bringing child rights and development experts together to develop a truly child right focused campaign against child poverty. A rights-based approach allows civil society groups to examine budgetary proposals and their impact on child rights. There's a rich experience of good practices in this area, which should be shared during your conference tomorrow. As I see it, it's time to take human rights out of its box. Human rights work, whether at the level of theory or in implementation of policies, has reached a stage of maturity where it can integrate the insights and tools from disciplines and professions other than the purely legal. In other words, human rights are no longer just a lawyer's preserve. There's space and need for much broader intellectual and scholarly attention to the subject, as well as for integrating human rights into the practical and policy programs that seek to advance human development and human security. So the new project that I've been developing since leaving the UN with a number of colleagues, including Stephanie Grant, who's sitting here in the second row quietly. Nice to see you, Stephanie. The initiative that we've been working on seeks to foster greater coherence in language and research agendas between development and human rights experts. Our aim is to focus on the role of human rights in relation to some of the major development challenges of the day, such as child poverty, and identify the synergies that can be derived from looking at these issues from the dual perspective of human rights and development policy. We believe that the tools of human rights can and should be used by economic and development policymakers. Conversely, it's my conviction that human rights work should be connected more effectively to the objectives of democracy and development. EGI is glad to be invited to contribute to some strategic initiatives on children in the coming months. In early February 2004, a number of global women leaders, including I'm also invited, will be meet at Bellagio, Italy, on the initiative of Marion Wright Edelman, president of the Children's Defence Fund, to, and I quote, develop actions and strategies we can take individually and collectively within and among our key networks and nations to save child lives and lead towards broader changes in global priorities. Identify one or two achievable goals we can pursue in the near future to make a measurable difference for the world's children and agree on next steps. So in essence, the idea is to harness women's leadership to the cause of child rights, which curiously has not been done sufficiently in the past. And I think that this will be a valuable initiative. Later in 2004, we would hope to combine with the newly established African Child Policy Forum and African women leaders in a conference to focus in particular on support systems for AIDS orphans in Africa. Currently, it is estimated that some 13 million children under 15 have lost one or both parents because of AIDS, and most of them are in sub-Saharan Africa. This figure is predicted to rise to 25 million by 2010. In order to get the priority attention that is needed to really tackle the foulest wounds of child poverty, I believe we need to make a stronger link between human rights, human development, and human security. This link is made in the newly released report of the Commission on Human Security called Human Security Now. There's a real opportunity to take up the Commission's broader approach to human security as an entry point to focus on economic, social, and cultural rights in general and on the economic, social, and cultural rights of the child in particular. And I would encourage you all to discuss this during tomorrow's conference as you explore future directions for alleviating child poverty. And since looking at the clock, we have reasonable time, I thought I would just refer to one memory that I have spoken about before because it stays with me so vividly, because it was purely an issue of poverty, and yet it was a fundamental human rights issue. I was in Delhi in India for a period of time because there were a number of different functions and events, and I had time to go and visit a number of small projects in Delhi. One of them was in the heart of the worst slum in Delhi. And I actually remember that my colleagues who were with me said that the Delhi authorities in the ministry that was dealing with it had first of all said, no, it wouldn't be safe and it's very dirty and it's not appropriate for somebody of that high standing. And my colleague said, I wouldn't try and stop her. So anyway, we went. And it was quite true that the whole surrounds were very crowded, very dirty, very smelly, all the signs of terrible poverty on the bank of a polluting river and so on. And I was visiting a very small NGO called STOP, S-T-O-P, and they were focused on three things. They were focused on education for the children, most of whom were orphans for violence or AIDS and drugs. And secondly, training women, particularly on health. And the third thing was earning money from making candles. And in fact, I was given a present of a bundle of candles. And there was a television crew there, and it was very small and crowded. And then they said, and we'd like you to meet somebody who is an enormous friend. And they introduced me to a policeman who was supportive. And how incredibly important it was to have a policeman who was actually on their side. And afterwards, when I was in a different context, I was speaking with the president of India, and I mentioned this to him, because it was the former president whom I had met on a number of occasions, and we were pretty informal with each other. And I said how striking it was that the policeman was such a valuable friend. And he said, oh, give me his name. And I said, I won't, because I don't want him promoted out of there. You know, leave him where he is. And then when I was coming out, I was asked, would you allow the children to sing for you? Which was kind of strange for me in a way, because when I was president of Ireland, that was very regular. The singing and dancing were a regular feature, you know, of come dance with me in Ireland. And at the same time, it wasn't that usual in a human rights context. But I immediately said, yeah, sure, I'd love to hear the children sing. And we went out into this narrow, grotty alleyway with, you know, open sewage down the middle of it. And I suddenly realized that there were a lot of children squatting down. And I remember, it's a visual memory, that they rose to their feet. And I realized there were, I'd say, 70 or 80 of them. And they sang beautifully in Hindi, "We shall overcome." And they sang it to the end. And as I listened to those children in that place singing that song that I associate with my time as a law student in the 70s and the, you know, the sense of what it meant to the United States, what it meant in South Africa, and here were these children singing, "We shall overcome one day." And all I could say to myself is, how will you overcome? How on earth will you overcome? And that is what we are about, and that's what you're about in the conference tomorrow. It's the future of children like that who have such a hope, such a sense that the world is their future, and we deny it to so many. So this conference has to make a difference. Thank you.
I appreciate some of you may well have class. It's coming up to 2 o'clock. Don't feel at all embarrassed that you may have to leave. Thank you for coming. We have 25 minutes or so for questions and indeed contributions. They don't have to be a question. I think all the speakers are available. And we have Mary, but we also have people very heavily involved in the writing of this report and in the creating of this culture which will underpin a battle against poverty. So feel free either to make an observation or to direct a question to any one of the number of people we have on the panel. I would ask, however, a couple of things. One is that you tell us who you are, if you feel able to, because it sometimes helps to focus the nature of the question. And secondly, if you could be brief. It does assist other speakers, and in deference to our own speakers who've been so succinct, such briefness will be welcome. I see the gentleman here. I'm going to take two or three, perhaps, in one go. I see a gentleman at the top here, and we'll take this person right at the back to start. Sir.
Yes, I'd like to say thank you to all of you for the work that you're doing. My name is Josh Kuczynski. I wonder whether you could make a comment about something that's often put forward as one of the big problems, which is corruption. And I wondered whether you had any thoughts on how one deals with corruption and whether it is one of the major problems.
Josh, are you from an organisation or?
Well, I'm a member of the British Humanist Association.
Thank you. Not that I want to just pigeonhole you, but it's helpful to people. I'm taking the U there is at Mary or generally. Yeah. I think I said somebody up here first, didn't I? Yes. Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Good day. My name is Shahid, and I'm from Pakistan. And I have a question to Ms. Robinson. You just mentioned, and we've been hearing about it in our classes as well, that there's falling commitment to the fact of child poverty and to the social services in general. So I'd like to raise a point, and I wonder if it's relevant, and you may shed light on that, please. In my country, in Pakistan, and especially in the Northwest Frontier Province and in Balochistan, we've seen a phenomenon that rose and shook the world, which was finally seen as the incident of 9/11, and I'm referring to the Taliban and the fundamentalism that's on the rise in the Muslim world in general, and in particular in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. And in addition to its political aspect, it's got a very strong social milieu to it, which is child poverty, because the seminaries in which this fundamentalism is taught are basically meant for the poorest of the poor, and the children who can't be fed and can't be clothed by their parents are sent to these seminaries. And something that starts with that level of poverty is, you can then see the political manifestation of the whole thing as it comes out in the form of this acute fundamentalism. So the point I want to raise is that if somehow or the other the rich countries and the powerful countries, and like in Europe and America, are made to realize that it's in their favor, in their own future's favor, that more commitment is made to the social front so that we and them together are saved from this kind of fundamentalist outcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shahid. And finally, before we go back to the panel, I think, madam.
Linda Korsha, I'm from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. How can children's rights improve without a major focus on women's rights and without making women's rights central? Pakistan, particularly in question, the rest of South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Middle East, the problem right across those countries is the lack of women's rights. I'd also like to ask, isn't it a waste of time taking the measures that you're talking about if the overriding effects of the World Trade Agenda agreements are counterproductive in that regard?
Thank you. I'll take that as a kind of you, plural. I might ask Mary perhaps to begin the response, but then I would like to draw other members of the panel in.
Okay. Thank you. Three good questions, or indeed I make it four. First of all, on the importance of corruption, I fully agree with that. I am very aware of the corroding impact on human rights in every sense. When the police are corrupt, when judges are corrupt, when officials are corrupt, when there's a siphoning off to the elite, etc. I work closely with Peter Eigen in Transparency International. He's, in fact, on the advisory council of our new initiative. I speak more and more about human rights and tackling corruption. And if I could just say so, corruption is not a problem only of developing countries. Corruption is an intense problem of developed countries, including Ireland, my country, and Conor's country. And it was very telling about a year ago when there was the finding of a tribunal which used plain, ordinary language and said of a former Irish foreign minister, he was corrupt. What he did was corrupt. And it rocked the Irish establishment in a mature, prosperous country nowadays. So it's not easy to tackle corruption, even in secure, developed countries. And we need to realize how pervasive it is, how undermining of development and human rights, and how hard to tackle. So we need to be very strategic, and I think we need to do a great deal more in that area. Secondly, the questioner from Pakistan, I think that you've articulated very well the point I was just hinting at the end, that we need to link these issues with human security, as you have very rightly done. We need to do it in a way that is not calling everybody in the world terrorism, that recognizes that fundamentalism is not confined to Islamic countries. There's Christian fundamentalism, which also is causing a lot of problems in our world, including problems for rights of women and rights of the child. But I do think that there is more attention being paid to the link between poverty and human security. I know that Dr. Chen in Harvard has written on that, and I heard him speak about it recently at a meeting in New York of the Hilton Foundation. So that was the point I was making. Since human security is the great sort of shadow in the back of all of our minds, and you can get resources for human security that you can't get otherwise, that perhaps to link more issues of poverty, particularly child poverty, in the way that you were suggesting, and just as one facet of it, may help to get more attention to child poverty. And the first point that was made at the back here by the representative of the Women's International League of Peace, and I agree with you that women's rights are fundamental to this issue, and indeed that's why I'm so glad that during next year African women leaders will be addressing as women leaders the rights of children, but also in fact exercising their own rights, as saying we need to be heard more, we need to have our priorities listened to. So that's a connection that we will be definitely making. And I also agree with you that the impact of the WTO trade barriers is something that we have to look at very consciously. And again, in our initiative, we're seeking to address this in a very specific way with a human rights analysis of trade. Let me put it in rough figures. I hope I've got the figures right, because I'm never good on statistics unless I have looked at them 5 minutes beforehand. But I think it's calculated that the trade barriers to agricultural imports that would cost developing countries about $320 billion a year, and the global development aid globally is $50 billion. So we trap countries in poverty, where they would wish to trade out of poverty and then be able to look after the rights of children and of women. So it is a dimension that I think it was right to bring out.
Thank you. I would like to bring in other members of the panel, perhaps on that last point about, you know, whether the report can take effect in the current political climate, or the more general points. Do we have any volunteers?
I'd just say, like to address the question on women's rights and children's rights and UNICEF's work across the world. What we have found is you cannot begin to fulfill a child's right if the mother's legal status is inferior to that of the husband, that she has no control over resources, or she's not in the position to go to the health center when she needs to and must ask permission of the husband. So very much this is at the center of our work, the integration of women's rights and children's rights. And overall, creating a culture of respect for human rights, I think, is what we aim for, and certainly this report contributes in the poverty debates.
Yes, I'd just like to add to answer some of those questions. On corruption, again, I'd just like to reemphasize how important it is. Often you are told when discussing poverty that in the poorer countries, they cannot alleviate poverty because of the massive burden of debt. And similarly, in industrialized countries, there's often the need to pay off the national debt, and therefore there's less money available for anti-poverty policies. It's rare you'll find the country has gone deeply into debt following policies that benefited the poor. The debt was not incurred for the poor often. It was often incurred following policies that benefited the rich and the elites in those countries. That's much broader than the narrow confines of political corruption, but I think that's a point that needs to be borne in mind. That's not to say that debt relief shouldn't go ahead and needs to go ahead. It's not the poor's fault that those debts were incurred. On the point about the Taliban and child poverty, it is of course very important that child poverty is dealt with, not just because of fundamentalism, which occurs across the world, but in its own right as well. Although if a lever can be used on that basis, then I'm in favour of using that argument. But I don't think that's the main argument for tackling child poverty. I think child poverty and child rights are fundamental in themselves, and we should tackle child poverty and child rights. And then a whole lot of good consequences will occur, including a reduction in some of the these problems that we've had in, say, on the borders of Pakistan.
It isn't discussed in the report, but the second questioner raises the issues to do with poverty being extended to some of the outcomes of civil war and violence. And I think we do have to extend the analysis to those areas because they're becoming so, as it were, an insistent wound on world society and its discussion. And that means that we have to have a very healthy sense of the preventable aspects of any work that is done on security in relation to removing poverty, especially child poverty. On corruption, just to, as it were, call attention to one thing which is often dodged in its discussion, is that we often don't look at the issue of institutional organization of corruption rather than the issue of democratic governance. And we need to insist on comparing the kind of corruption that arises in companies like Enron and WorldCom with the kind of corruption that can occur within government. The two are very much more linked than we often care to admit. And on the final point about the World Trade Organization, I'm very conscious that there are some campaigning groups struggling to assert a more reasoned analysis comparing rich and poor countries. You get examples like Kevin Watkins' report on double standards for Oxfam last year, which does begin to suggest the kind of open analysis we all need to make of the subsidies that are being applied in the rich world to compare with the kind of concessions that often ought to be made to in the exchanges about tariffs in the poor world.
Thank you, Peter. Three people have already caught my eye. I have this gentleman and that lady, but in between me have this lady, I think, at the front. And I am going to prioritize this group who have yet to speak after that. Can we remind ourselves that we need to give our name and briefly where we're from and keep our questions or comments short so we can fit even more in, sir?
Yes. My name is Tony Sousa, and I'm a community development person who now lives in Canada and has worked in India, especially in the slums. And I'm always caught by what I term as professionalism that seems to exist. When I worked in India, I remember when I worked in the slums, people coming who were professionals who came to give us advice and came to tell people how to solve their problems. And they went away, and I remember talking to the people, and the message I got from them was, but look how they live. How can they talk about equality when you look at how they live and what message they give us? And I think we have this sort of, I don't know, schizophrenic way of living sometimes, where we professional people, don't seem to know how to live simply. So that, and the term goes to live simply so others may simply live. But take that further, and I wonder what kind of a message we give to people in terms of how, because if we don't do it by example, but if we do it by just talking about it, it's not going to work. I think people have got to see us, got to see some real ways in which we demonstrate quite clearly that we are committed to this stuff and that, and to these policies and that we're actually doing that.
Thank you for that. Madam, you were actually next in line, but I meant for you third, or sir. Yes. It's on its way. It's on its way.
Thanks very much. Carrie Pemberton, University of Cambridge. I'm also an Anglican priest, so I welcomed what Mary Robinson said about human rights impinging on the economic, the moral, the spiritual, the social, and the political. And I guess what I wonder is how we work with bringing into participation those religious bodies that we also have great worries about. You mentioned religion, and people veer towards, it's fundamentalism. But there are many, many religious organizations that are part of the substructure of people's lives. And yet here in the West, we don't often recognize them as part of civil society because they've been a civil nuisance. And quite how we work in affecting, looking at child's participation and rights affected through those religious organizations. I wonder if the panel could respond to that.
Thank you very much. And we have this lady here, and I'm still looking at the quiet group. But there's this lady. We have endless numbers of hands up elsewhere, but please.
Thank you. Caroline Cross, I'm an LLM student here at LSE, and it's a very brief question to do with your methodology used in the report. Elizabeth Giddens spoke of innovative data selection, and I'm just wondering how exactly you collected your data, whether you sent in working groups or were there groups within the countries themselves who are working? Thank you.
Thank you. And on gender as well as locational bias, I'm glad to draw this gentleman in as our final question in this set.
Right. My name's Chris Palm, and I'm a researcher in international adoption. And I wondered whether anybody on the panel would like to talk about the need to strengthen the rights of children not to be exported from the land of their birth and the land of poverty to families in rich countries, bearing in mind perhaps the recent UK Adoption Act, which makes this process so much easier.
Thank you very much. I am going to ask the speakers to be succinct, and perhaps we will be able to pack in a number of questions. There are a tremendous number of hands up as we draw to the conclusion, annoyingly. So, Mary.
Well, I'll pass on the last two questions, because I think others can answer them much more authoritatively. On the first question on professionalism, I very much agree, but I must say when we were working in the context of the Office of High Commissioner, the idea was to encourage people to use the tools they had, to empower them with those tools, which were the tools of the international human rights system. So we didn't feel that we came and preached and left without any message. And we were clearly encouraging them of the importance of informing themselves, of participation, of accountability, and we could resource, and the committees were there in Geneva, and that was the idea, that was the relationship. And we related all of our work to the tools that the human rights system gave them, and that I'm happy to say civil society worldwide is increasingly availing of. For those of you who are interested in this, there's a very good website, ESCR-net, which is a website of human rights environmentalists and development workers who are sharing good practices in looking at the World Bank, looking at the IMF, looking at the experiences, looking at the accountability of governments, etc. And I think that this is a welcome trend of the moment of real empowerment, sustainable empowerment. The Anglican priest from Cambridge, I sense that really, beginning with the Millennium Declaration, Millennium Assembly rather, that religious groups are being heard more and insisting on being heard more on the side of thinking about these issues. You remember there was the great gathering of the leaders of various faiths at the time of the Millennium Assembly. Certainly I'm aware of, because I'm getting invitations that I can't take up, of the number of contexts in which Christian, Jewish and Muslim church leaders in different countries are coming together to examine problems. In the context of children, the problem, I think, is that there's such an unresolved, deep issue of child abuse, of abuse by religious orders, big problem in my native country, Ireland, and the failure to give leadership on that has been, I think, very damaging for some of the more progressive voices within the Christian churches. As it happens, I go from here to Amman to take part in an Arab Women's Summit, which will be looking at interreligious dialogue, and that will have a lot of spiritual dimension to it, I have no doubt.
Mary, that leaves a couple. Elizabeth.
So I'm going to address the two questions based on my experience with working in Guatemala, but it's an experience that is similar for any UNICEF country program, which, first of all, of course, we work with religious organizations as very often the best means for getting the message about child rights out. I can give the example in Guatemala has a lot of religious fractures, but one of the, we work together with a whole, what we call the table of consensus, to examine the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and that they put then within their perspective how that can be applied in the context of their particular faith. Of course, these were all Christian churches. And the fundamentalist evangelicals were actually the most motivated and the most dynamic in then taking the convention and bringing it to every parish in the country, in the most rural areas, and speaking of what now, how this relates to this verse in the Bible. So it's extremely important and certainly done in many contexts. Again, from Guatemala is the question on international adoption. Certainly, not the only way, but a way to ensure that children get to stay with their family is by providing support to that family, that they don't feel through poverty they have to give up the child. So that in UNICEF's programs across the world, we very much try to strengthen the family, strengthen the government support for the family, while recognizing, as the International Hague Convention does recognize, that there are cases for the individual child where international adoption is the best. But certainly poverty should not be the reason for giving up a child. So, I mean, that to say that a child is better off because of material context in a family that's not their own is unacceptable. It's like saying a poor family's love is of no importance. So while recognizing that in some cases it's necessary and in the best interest of the child, all of the work needs to go to making it impossible for a child to be given up for reasons of poverty alone.
Thank you. And either of both?
Yes, just to answer the data question, one of the major advances in social sciences in literally the past 2 or 3 years has become the availability of high-quality survey data, which allows you to do a planet-wide analysis. There have been a whole series of surveys, the World Bank's Living Standard Measurement Surveys, the World Health Surveys, the UNICEF's multiple indicator cluster surveys, and the demographic and health surveys that are now available free of charge over the internet. This data was put together mainly from demographic and health surveys, which are surveys of mainly the main care of the child, mainly the mother, and giving information about their child. They're highly representative of the developing world. On adoption, I'd like to re-emphasize that no child should have to be adopted and given up because of poverty. However, a fundamental advance from the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child is that children have, is a recognition that children have rights that are co-equal and independent of adults. And the Hague Convention, which governs the International Adoption Act in the UK and has been signed by many countries, gives children the right to international adoption where they cannot be adopted in their own country. It is better, children have a right to family life, they should not have to grow up in orphanages. It is far better for them not to be given up in the first place, certainly not for poverty reasons. It's far better for them to be adopted in their own countries, but where that cannot happen, they should have the right, the fundamental right, to international adoption and therefore to family life. And unfortunately, one of the effects of the increase in AIDS in the world is, I suspect, international adoption is going to become more necessary, not less.
Just one final comment on the first question, is interest in professional standards. I think it is not always agreed that commitment to human rights involves commitment to not necessarily changing one's own personal behaviour, but certainly acting as professionals, and many people are aware of the difficulty sometimes of reconciling professional work as experts sailing into a country and sailing out again after a fortnight's conference, or NGO work in a particular country and somehow trying to acclimatise and understand the real problems while keeping very distinct in the style of living. I'm saying this simply because this applies to all of us in some senses. We have to have some kind of sensitivity, if we believe in human rights, to the way in which we behave, not only in, as it were, setting examples, but how that permeates our professional activities too. And I can't help remembering that the word forerunners, it's easier to talk historically about politicians, but if you go back and learn anything about George Lansbury, who led the Labour Party in the 1920s and 30s, or even about Herbert Morrison, you will appreciate that there are some politicians who understand that the way they behave and live actually represents some of their social and political values.
Thank you. We are really up against the clock. It may be that we've heard the last from some of our panellists. There's a lady right at the back, and there's a lady in the blue who's been trying to get in, and then there's Claire, and then I think we must call a halt to it, but there'll be opportunities to continue the discussions tomorrow. Very, very briefly, if you would, please,
okay,
but not forgetting to tell us who you are.
My name's Melissa Davis, and I just work in the private sector. I wanted to ask Mary Robinson about her point about human rights coming outside of the lawyer's remit and working with and development policy, but to ask you about corporate policy, and do you think there's a role for human rights to be working with the companies that are in these countries? Particularly, I do a lot of work with Shell, and they have a human rights policy thing, but the dialogue at the moment is quite weak on the human rights side. And there's also skepticism from the NGOs about talking to them, and I was just wondering how you think that could open up more.
Thank you, Melissa. Madam.
Hi, Sinead McBurty, also private sector. A very similar point to the last speaker. One is about really how poverty is impacted by its lack of commercialism, by the lack of profitability in fixing poverty, as far as the corporates go and where money sits and how these things get addressed. And the second is the short-termism inherent in national domestic politics, and really, I suppose, how those two things impact trying to eradicate poverty in the long term.
Thank you. Not least for the succinctness. And finally, in the front row here, with apologies to those who haven't been able to get in, Ms. Carolyn.
United States back in the UNICEF.
Claire O'Brien from the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. Mary mentioned the need to bring together the language and research agendas of human rights and development. So I just wondered if we could hear a little bit more about that, similarly perhaps to the previous two questions, particularly in relation to the use of human rights indicators instead of traditional economic ones to measure poverty, and also perhaps addressing some of the problems that may have stood in the way of achieving the fusion of those two agendas in the past and today, and sort of what are the most important achievements on the road to fulfilling it now.
Thank you. I think what I might do is ask Mary to speak very briefly on behalf of the panel as well as myself, if I may impose on you an impossible duty, lest you miss your flight.
Well, let the others feel free to come in if I say something they don't agree with or wish to be associated with. First question in relation to the private sector, thank you for opening up this dimension. I think it's very relevant. Certainly in our initiative, we're increasingly linking with business, really on two fronts. We have to monitor the impact of business, particularly in developing countries. And there is, at the moment, a very current issue in relation to the role that companies played in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's before the Security Council, and my understanding is there's some attempt to water down and disguise the damage that was done by rapacious, if that's the word, corporations with the connivance of senior ministers of their governments. And that's a horrible, bad scene that I hope will be used to show the damage that can be done. But equally, I'm more and more impressed by a business-led debate of, you know, what is the borderline between the responsibility of government and now, because of privatization of power in relation to a lot of services like education, health, even prison services, etc., and the weakness of developing countries, what's the role of business? And just because we haven't time, there are two initiatives that we're involved in that are on the website of the Ethic of Globalization Initiative, which is www.eginitiative.org. And one of them is a business leaders initiative on human rights, and there'll be a big conference about it here in London on the 9th of December, and it's seven companies led at CEO level, significant companies, looking at the UN Subcommission on Human Rights norms and responsibilities of transnational corporations and the commentaries on those norms. In other words, does business now find that a normative framework would be appropriate, or some business say business regulates itself, we don't want any UN regulation, thank you very much. There's a big debate on that, which is very interesting. The second initiative is tackling racism and xenophobia in the European Union. There's a very good model in Sweden called Plural, involving 15 corporations, which has made business a positive business value. Made diversity a positive business value. And we're sowing the seeds of that in some other EU countries. And we hope that in a few years' time, every EU country will have a leadership from business which will influence media. And we won't have so much, you know, this kind of swamped by migrants and all these kind of horrible uses of language that are used. We'll have a business debate. It's good for us. It's good for our business. We like this diversity. We believe in multiculturalism and so on. And sorry, the second question was also, the lack of profitability. The way you put that question reminded me of something that really struck me in the Vaccine Fund board. I'm on that board and was at the first meeting that I was able to attend recently in South Africa. The Vaccine Fund was established in the year 2000 with a lot of Gates money, so private sector money, and now there's government support. And it has created a market for vaccinating children in very poor rural areas. And the formula is very simple, $20 per child vaccinated, but you don't get it all in one go. It works with Gavi, that UNICEF and other UN agencies, governments and civil society are involved in. But I literally saw the way the creation of a new market for access to vaccines, you get the $10 if you satisfy certain criteria, and you get the other 10 if other criteria are satisfied. And it's helping to develop health systems in the 60 countries that are the target countries for these vaccines. And I think the Global Fund for addressing HIV/AIDS, malaria and tuberculosis is embryonically doing the same thing. And I think there's a great value in bringing the focus on health systems. Now, that was a private sector initiative that created a market. And it makes us all think how much more we could do if we had similar approaches. And then about the language of human rights and development and human rights indicators. I forgot who asked that, but yes, here. If I could just say on that, to me, the most interesting area there is the human rights analysis of PRSPs, poverty reduction strategies, and the way in which increasingly the World Bank is at least open to a language that the PRSPs must put in the center, women's rights, child rights, and have different indicators in the PRSPs. They say that governments won't accept this, governments of some developing countries, but it's certainly very interesting. And I think where the, and Paul Hunt, the special rapporteur on right to health, has done some very good work in that area.
Thank you very much. I wonder whether we have, I just want to say I'm fairly new to the LSE, and I think I'm constantly surprised and amazed, as are the speakers, and again today, by the quality of the questions and the points of discussion that you raised. It really was a terrific session. I'm so glad we had so much time to cover so much. So you should later, when congratulating the speakers, congratulate yourselves. I think it's also clear that intellectual events like these can produce outcomes. I think it's marvellous we ended on a high note like that from Mayor Robinson, and the LSE itself is testimony to that. So is UNICEF, and so are organisations like the Townsend Centre in Bristol. So this is not just a talking shop, it produces outcomes that are successful. And the person who kind of epitomises that is somebody like Mayor Robinson, with whom we're so pleased to have here. And I'd like to just say again that this conference tomorrow is still open to people if they haven't registered. I believe it's possible to come along. It's on children's rights and child poverty, and participating in conferences like that creates the intellectual space for the actions by people like Bill Gates and well-disposed political leaders. So it is a very important engagement in itself, apart altogether from any possible outcomes that it may produce intellectually. We have a conference at the Centre for the Study of Human Rights on asylum, a one-day conference on the 1st of November, Asylum, Humans Without Rights. I'm glad to say it looks as though we're going to fill this hall. Tickets are going very fast. It's on Saturday, the 1st of November. And that's another example of trying to engage on our terms through the language of human rights with people at the margins of our society. I'd like, having mentioned the conference tomorrow, just to end by thanking Peter Townsend, David Gordon, Elizabeth Gibbons, and particularly, of course, as our keynote speaker and for fitting us in a busy schedule, Mayor Robinson, for having provided such a terrific lunchtime talk.